Hey everybody, it's Judy Warner with All Tim's On Track podcast. Welcome back. We have another amazing guest for you today. But before we get started, please follow me on LinkedIn. I post a lot of things for engineers and PCB designers, and I'd love to connect with you. And on Twitter, I'm at AllTMJudy, and AllTM is also on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. So please give us a follow. Well, today I have a really extra special treat for you. Zach, I think I'm going to destroy your last name, so I can say Zach.
Yeah.
Your last name is?
Homuth.
Homuth. See, I would have killed it. So okay. This is Zach Homuth from, he is one of the, you're a co-founder of Converter,
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
So we acquired, Altium acquired Converter and EE Concierge in August of 2017. So a lot of people have asked me why Converter, what was Altium's interest in Converter, because it seems like sort of out of our lane. So I thought I'd bring Zach in today and let you hear straight from the horse's mouth. So start out by, if you would, Zach, just telling us about what is Converter and what is EE Concierge and what you're trying to create when you launch that company.
Yeah, sure. So Converter is cloud-based schematic capture and PCB layout. And what cloud-based means is it runs in the web browser. You type Converter.com into Google Chrome, it shows up, and you can do your schematics, your layouts, right there. You know, order the boards for manufacturing right from your web browser. You don't need to download anything. It's collaborative, which was kind of our big superpower for a really long time, which is that a bunch of users can work on the same schematic and the same layout at the same time in a very Google Docs kind of way.
Yeah,
but that's Converter. And then EE Concierge came out of an experiment we ran back in 2015 trying to figure out what was the most frustrating part of doing a PCB design. Mm-hmm. And it turned out it was making and checking parts. And Converter, until that point, had a shared global parts library. And what that meant was every time you added a part, every time I added a part, those parts were available for the community.
Right.
But without somebody checking those
parts. Yeah, that could be a nightmare.
Yeah, it was really scary for people. They were spending a lot of time checking parts. They were spending a lot of time making their own copy of a part that was already in the library. A lot of that, you know, wasted, duplicated.
You cannot have a messy library. That's
And so EE Concierge grew out of that. It was our attempt to clean up and verify and guarantee the quality of the parts inside of Converter. And so we built a small army of electrical engineers all over the world. They work in an Uber-like model where they can kind of log on, make a couple of parts, check a couple of parts, log off again.
Wow.
They can do it full time. They can do it 20 hours a day. They can do it an hour a day, you know, or an hour a week if that's what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we built a machine intelligence to check all the work that they were doing to make sure that we had the best possible parts in the world inside the Converter parts library. And then, anyways, EE Concierge was born out of realizing that that's probably not specific to Converter. Probably every engineer has this
problem. Yeah, there's that.
So we built a plugin for Altium Designer so that Altium users could leverage these verified parts, which inevitably caught the eye of Altium, and one thing led to another. But that, you know, that's EE Concierge. It was this idea of verified parts at scale, and then kind of outsourcing at scale for electrical engineering, but in like a high quality way.
Right. So how many parts do you know? How many parts are in the library now?
Yeah, so there's about 1.5 million parts.
Holy cow.
In the Converter library. Of those 1.5 million, about 275,000 are verified these days. And to different levels of verified. Some of them just have verified symbols, some have verified footprints. It depends on kind of what era of EE Concierge they were made in. But we've got about 25,000 like really, really rock solid ones, and they're the 25,000 that most people use. So.
That's awesome. So what's the plan kind of going forward to get the rest of them? You said you have some kind of machine learning to help verify that. Like, what's the path going forward to get the rest? Or, you know, 1 million parts, like you said, not everybody's using 1 million parts.
Right.
Right. It there's infrequent.
Yeah, so there's kind of
wonky ones in
there. Yeah, there's kind of two answers to that. So how we make this maximally useful to the most engineers is similar to what Altium and Octopart did after Octopart was acquired.
Right,
we worked really, really hard to make sure that Octopart was for everybody. It wasn't just, you know, Octopart for Altium. It wasn't just parts for Altium. It was Octopart for everybody. OrCAD, you know, Mentor, everybody.
Right.
So we're trying to do the same thing with the eConcierge. We
okay.
want verified parts for everyone. So.
Okay.
In the next couple weeks, we're going to launch verified parts on Octopart. So we're taking that 250,000 parts and we're putting them on Octopart, free for everybody to use. And you can download them in Eagle, Altium, Upverter. We're working on Mentor. I think we've got Cadence OrCAD as part of that. So like in any format, free, just find them, download them, use them. That's, you know, that's what we want. So that's kind of one avenue for the eConcierge. And then the other is, this is a little bit more kind of futurist and out there answer.
That's okay.
But if you were going to build an AI that could read data sheets,
yeah.
the first thing you would do is have a huge number of people read data sheets and enter that information very reliably into a piece of software so that you
right.
can check it all. And so the kind of like dot, dot, dot is we think if we get good enough at doing EE Concierge and we do it for long enough, potentially we can read data sheets with a computer and
so
you know, kind of our self-driving car version of the Uber model.
Like, and then part of me goes, and you're assuming that data sheets are correct.
Yes.
there's that.
Yeah, it's a real problem. And so we had to do a lot of stuff at EE Concierge to catch, you know, like if TI ships a data sheet and the data sheet has a problem, they'll rev the data sheet and then they'll rev the data sheet.
Right.
And then not only that, but they'll reuse packages and they'll reuse symbols and they'll reuse bits and pieces of
right.
that data sheet across other parts that they make.
Mm-hmm.
We had to build a ton of stuff to be able to catch when they made an update to one data sheet and apply those changes to all the other parts that
Holy
use the same
cow.
Bits and pieces of the data sheet. It was a it's an ongoing thing. It's a hard problem for us, but yeah, it's a real issue.
Well, it's like amazing to me that we're here, like
at
like
all.
As, yeah, no, I mean just you know, from being in, like, I started in the industry way back in the 80s, and like everything was done so, you know, by hand and all that. So just. That we could possibly even get to that point is just so sci-fi to me, but it's amazing. It's so great. So tell us a little bit about why Upverter. How'd you get?
Yeah.
Tell us about your personal history and how you went down the Upverter rabbit hole and popped up here.
So I was kind of into software and computers before, you know, that was a cool thing. I was on the internet pretty early. I was, I think, 5 or 6 when my dad brought home, you know, our first computer. And, and you know, I tore it apart and tried to figure all that kind of stuff out. I was building video games when I was 7. And,
of course
you
were.
All that stuff. but I studied computer engineering at the University of Waterloo in Canada. And computer engineering is a little bit of software engineering, a little bit of electrical engineering, and then, you know, all the physics and boring normal engineering stuff that you have to do. And Waterloo is a co-op university, and so every 4 months you'd go to school.
Oh, I love those.
And then every 4 months you'd go get a job. And so I got a bunch of these cool jobs kind of all over the world. I used it as an excuse to travel. And so I worked in Canada's capital, Ottawa, for the insurance company that insures the majority of Canadian doctors. And so they had some really interesting data, and I built a search engine and a database for them to be able to search, you know, when wrong side surgeries happen, right? They, you know, they operate on the wrong lung or whatever.
Right,
and so
I
built a search engine so that doctors could figure out the root cause of some of this, you know, some of this error, because it was important for the insurance company to try to prevent this from happening.
Yeah,
and
just
so
saying.
I did that. I worked in Germany for IBM. I worked in India for Infosys. And then I got a job in Waterloo working for a company called Sandvine. And Sandvine built what are called deep packet inspection telecommunications servers. And so ISPs would install these in their network, and it would sit between their subscribers, the people who use the internet,
right,
and the rest of the internet,
uh-huh,
and it would look at all the traffic that flowed through the box, mm-hmm, and it would try to figure out, you know, how much is Skype, and how much is YouTube, and how much is, mm-hmm, pornography, and Facebook, and everything,
right,
else.
Right.
Because if you think about it, ISPs are kind of like, it's kind of like the water utility. They know that they sold so much water, but they don't really know,
right,
what the water was used for, right?
Right.
How much is watering lawns,
right? Right.
And so we were giving ISPs that kind of intelligence. Anyways, I started off as a lab tech. I tore the boxes apart, tried to figure out why they weren't working, put them back together, made them work. And I kind of worked my way up to actually designing the box. So I designed two of them for Sandvine. Before quitting, and I quit because I was really frustrated that on our side of the cubicle wall, there were 10 of us working on the hardware that was so essential for this company to exist.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other side of the wall, there were 300 software guys who had Git, and they had version control, and they had collaborative tools,
right,
and they could test their code by pushing a button on their computer. I had to carry a 120-pound server around a building and use screwdrivers and shit to, like, and that's part of hardware. I don't, you know,
right,
I never wanted to take that away from hardware, but it felt like it could be easier.
Right.
And, you know, we were using Mentor Graphics tools, and I was frustrated by the archaic kind of 80s feel of it all.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I used a Mac at home. I couldn't,
right,
use the software on,
yeah,
my own computer,
yep,
if I wanted to. And I was trying to build stuff at home. And this was kind of before IoT was like a thing. This is,
right,
before Arduino, before all that stuff. But I wanted to do that stuff at home. And it was just so hard,
mm-hmm,
to do any of that, you know, from my Mac, from home, without a huge budget, or, you know,
right,
just an endless amount of time. And at the time, we were seeing cloud tools like Gmail and Google Docs,
mm-hmm,
and GitHub kind of emerging. And so I left because I was pretty frustrated that if this is, like, the state of the art, if, like, one of the most complicated telecommunications servers that anybody had built today was built by some punk kid, you know, in this office in Waterloo, working mostly alone, using tools that felt kind of clunky and out of date.
Right.
Like, there has to be something better than this.
Right.
And so we left to build it. And it was really no more complicated than, can we take some of the magic of GitHub and some of the magic of Google Docs,
mm-hmm,
and build a tool like that for hardware engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it takes forever to disrupt Mentor or Cadence or Altium or any of the big guys,
right,
that have been at this for decades.
Right.
But we assumed there were enough people like us that just,
right,
wanted to spend 2 hours on a Saturday afternoon designing a piece of hardware. There must be something we can build for them. And,
right,
a little bit like Google Docs, right? It doesn't have all the features. You,
yeah,
can't make fancy,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
tables. You can't do it all.
Yeah.
But it's slowly taking over the world. And we,
yeah,
we wanted to do the same thing for hardware.
Well, I think you point out something that I really notice. It seems like there's a block of people that are like my age, the old 80s people, and we've kind of just built upon old, and then there's the next generation that were five. Okay, I was 20 when I got my first computer. So you guys kind of grew up with these things in your hands,
yep,
and it, I think it's kind of hardwired in your brain.
Yep.
So I think you kind of know there's more efficient, better ways to do things. And we are building on old legacy stuff, so sometimes we just can't see it.
Yep.
And so I think it's really very exciting because I think people are going to, like, oh, thank God, somebody's built something modern, you know,
yep,
on the cloud that thinks and operates, you know, which I think was the big draw, actually, for Altium, which we can talk about that a little bit later. So the Upverter, I was going to ask you, but you've answered it partially, is why Upverter, out of the various other things you could do, why didn't you go into, I don't know,
you have a very
entrepreneurial spirit, so there's lots of things you could have done.
Sure.
Like, why did you pick this one thing?
Yeah, so when we started Upverter, I quit my job before I knew what I was going to do. I knew I wanted to build something. I knew I wanted to start a company. I knew I was kind of done with working for the man. And I recruited two of my kind of college roommates. So these are guys that went to Waterloo with me. We lived in this terrible, decrepit, rundown, you know, house next to the next to the campus, near the engineering buildings. And, you know, we lived together, we worked together, we did our co-op jobs together, we were thick as thieves. But I called them up and I said, you know, how do you feel about quitting your job and like doing something new? And they both quit like the next day. And so we got together in this old decrepit student townhouse and we wrote down, you know, 100 ideas of things that we were excited about, things that we were passionate about, things that, you know, we believed needed to be fixed. I was shouting loudly in the corner that we needed to build this hardware tool that was the Google Docs for hardware. That was my passion. That was what I was excited about. But Steve and Mike, they had some cool ideas of their own. There was a bunch of stuff that they wanted to build that a lot of it has actually been built, and a lot of it ended up being quite substantially large companies. So our second pick, our kind of the front runners.
Yeah, so what was on your cut list?
Yeah, so the second pick was we wanted to build drones, and this was before drones were cool.
Oh.
But we wanted to build very large-scale drones that would be towed behind container ships. And provide a bigger radar footprint than the ship can have itself because it's so close to the water.
Okay.
And you do this for a bunch of reasons, but the really burning reason at the time was Somalian pirates. If you could fly one of these drones above a container ship, you could get 10 or 100 times the radar footprint, so you could really move the ship before anything bad happened.
If
you wanted to. Anyways, a company ended up doing this and started right around the same time that we did and ended up being acquired for something on the order of $2 or $3 billion. And so we missed that one a little bit, but we just didn't even know where to start on it. But it was the second pick.
That's crazy. So we didn't really talk about this ahead of time, but I know around the time Altium Live went down, there was people kind of gurus in the industry, and they're like. So Altium Live was in October.
Yep.
So, and Altium acquired you guys in August. And I remember some people all the buzz, like, what are you guys doing? why that customer? So what I want to talk about is who uses Upferder. I'm thinking makers, hackers, hobbyists, and maybe EEs that want to be startups or do personal projects. Like, who do you think the Upferder audience is?
Yep.
And how does Upferder serve them? And how many people are on Upferder? Like, tell us about your ecosystem a little bit.
Yeah, so it's the misfits, mostly. These are the guys
that
are...
The land of the misfit toys.
Yeah,
I like those people.
It really is. These are the guys that are unserved by, you know, the ECAD industry at large. They're using operating systems or tool sets or computers that can't run traditional ECAD. They're in funny parts of the world. They're students. They don't have electrical engineering degrees in lots of cases.
Mm-hmm.
They're the weekend warriors that can't steal a copy of the ECAD that they use at work and bring it home.
Right.
They're makers and hobbyists and hackers, yes, but they're also... we helped some Nigerian kids put their country's first satellite into orbit.
That's cool.
Couldn't have done it using traditional ECAD tools.
We kind of love that.
Yeah, like we, some of the first augmented reality startups were built using Upferder. Kind of odd stuff like that, where you couldn't necessarily, use a traditional ECAD tool. You couldn't necessarily iterate at the cycles that one of those tools would let you iterate at. But also, like, children of the internet and, you know, Mac users and all that kind of stuff where they can't use a traditional ECAD tool.
Right.
But misfits, mostly. We think of them as kind of the not really the next generation of electrical engineers, but very much a different breed, a different type of doer of electronics.
Well, it is kind of grassroots, though. I think that we are going to see more amazing things like drones being dragged behind boats that are going to come up organically.
Yep.
And kind of like you, I think you're the perfect sort of head of this brand. Like, yeah, I dropped out of school. This wasn't working. I didn't like it, whatever. So I can see that happening over the next 5, 10, 20 years. I think we're going to see amazing stuff sort of out of that space. So how many people, I don't know how you quantify that, have used Upfurter or use Upfurter or actively log on a month or?
So
how do you do that?
At the time we were acquired by Altium, it was a little over 50,000 people used Upfurter. They use it in a very bursty way. They'll show up, they'll work frantically for 2 days, 10 days, a month.
Right.
And then they'll disappear, and we won't see them for a long time, and then they'll come back. And we correlate that with, you know, their kind of idea cycle, right? They'll have an idea, they'll get very excited about the idea, they'll work on the idea, they'll do that thing, and then they'll go away, you know, probably because they've built the thing and they want to play with it.
Right.
But it could just be that they, you know, their focus has moved and they're, you know, they're on to something new.
Right.
And then we'll see them come back, you know, 6 months, a year, you know. A couple of days later, depends on you know how much time and energy they put into their ideas.
Right.
But that's okay for us. Like we never aspired to be the daily tool like somebody like Altium is. Like we aspired to be this conduit for people to bring their ideas to life.
Right.
And you can only be as useful as people have ideas, right?
Right.
So if you have an idea every day, we can be useful every day.
Right.
But most people don't. Most people have inspiration quarterly or,
right.
you know, a couple times a year.
Right.
And that's, you know, so that's what that looks like. Mm-hmm. We have many thousands of monthly active users, so thousands and thousands of people log on every month to work on their ideas and their little projects. Mm-hmm. And the average project is worked on for quite a small amount of time relative to, you know, what you would expect from other ECAD tools. We'll see products going from conception to manufacturing in like 20 hours or less. And so that's, you know, that's pretty amazing if you consider that's, you know, 2 or 3 days of work for a regular
electrical engineer.
That's unbelievable.
So you said something earlier that I wanted to ask you about, and that was you mentioned that people can go into manufacturing.
Yeah.
Do you have sources like fabrication, assembly sources that are related to Upfurter?
Yeah, and we've had this in a couple of different forms over the years. We've had what we like to call the print button kind of refactored a couple of times inside of Upfurter. We're currently refactoring it again right now.
Right.
And part of that is as a result of the acquisition. We have another company we acquired, Siva, who does a lot of stuff in the manufacturing space, and we're refactoring our print button to use some of their technology
Okay.
To be better linked up with Octopart. So
right.
it should be a better experience for our users as a result of doing it. But yeah, over the years, we've had a button. You click it, you give us your credit card number, and a couple days later, something shows up in the mail, which is what you designed.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and it will do that again in the very near future.
And was that assembled also, or just the bare board?
We used to just do bare boards, and then we experimented with assembly for a little while. The newest, latest, and greatest version that we're working on right now will be fully assembled, and it'll probably include whatever enclosure your device fits inside
of. Oh, my gosh. I'm like ridiculously excited about this.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty cool.
Okay, so I don't always ask this, but I'm going to ask this now.
Okay.
Are you a geek or a nerd?
Geek, but I don't know why. I don't know what the difference is, really.
It's just your gut. It's just an open question. I think you're a geek because whatever. It's something we ponder here on the Entrad podcast. What is a nerd and what is a geek? We've decided geeks are cooler. Nerds seem more like, at least to me, physics, like Sheldon Cooper's.
Science.
Deep on the science side, but this has not been proven. So if anyone wants to comment below and tell us what you think a geek and a nerd is, we're all ears. So, but you were geeking out there. This is why I stopped you.
Okay.
Because I'm like, oh, you are like totally geeking out, and I'm tracking with you, man. I'm like, oh, this is like we're having a geeking out moment right now. So I was talking to our head of operations the other day, and I was just saying that during that Altium Live, people were asking, why would Altium, a professional e-tool, pick up Upfurter?
Yeah.
And basically, I think Altium has a vision to kind of embrace every level of PCB designer and also embrace and serve those misfits, those marginalized or that don't have access, right? You know, those that can pay for Altium Designer and they do it professionally, well, great.
Yes.
But that we want to serve the wider community. So I was asking Ted Pyle about it, and he was saying, and I just wanted to get you to chime in here, is that sort of what we were talking about earlier is that cloud, a lot of software programs are going to cloud-based. Mm-hmm. You know, there used to be security issues, but they've tightened those up.
Yep.
So technology is moving towards cloud-based, and if we don't sort of pay attention and go that way too, I think we'll be sort of left behind. And that also the next generation.
Yep.
Or the new, or the upcoming, or the grassroots, organically grown innovators, I think, are going to, like you, are going to be cloud natives, right? And and are going to be frustrated, like you were when you were at Waterloo. And to also meet those people where they are, not expect them to cough up the money or fit into our model, but figure out where they're going and what their model is and what their needs are. And so that's what I think Altium saw as very attractive, seeing Upverter as a huge enabler to serve that community. Would you agree with those?
Yeah, so when we were in the kind of acquisition process with Altium, I spent a lot of time on the phone with Aram, our CEO, talking about kind of his vision for the future of Altium and his vision for the future of electronics. And one of the things we talked a lot about was making Altium synonymous with PCB design. And part of that is you can't just serve the tradespeople in the mainstream.
If
there's a million people in their basements that have ideas that want to invent stuff, and those things include electronics, you need to be there if you're going to be synonymous with PCB design. And so so a big part of it was that. But then also a big part of it is like the world's changing. Knowledge work's moving to the cloud.
It is.
It's becoming collaborative. You know, the Windows operating system may or may not be the operating system of the future. You look at mobile, you look at tablets, you look at what's happening with Apple and, you know, all of that. There's a version of the world where Altium is constrained to only serving a chunk of the market because of the way we've built our technology. And so I don't know. Aram obviously hasn't said any of this, but there might be a little bit of this that is a hedge on the future.
Well, I can tell you that personally, it's a really exciting place to be because I love that. I love that, you know, I interact a lot with actually university students and that. But we've also gone to, you know, I went to the New York City Maker Faire, and to see what people are developing is so exciting. So to be able to serve that community and see what they come up with is just a blast. Like, I love to see it. And especially like you had said earlier with IoT, like, it's going to explode what we can make. And like you said, they're going to be making it in their garage, in their basement, in their shed.
It has to explode. Like, we're talking about, you know, billions of devices all over the world. Like
capital B,
Like 100 or 200,000 professional electrical engineers aren't going to invent billions of devices.
Yeah.
We need to include a bigger chunk of the world in the design of these things.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and that's not to say that tradespeople won't have their place. Like, of course they will, but we need the grassroots. We need people building stuff in their basement, and we need it at a scale that we've never needed it at more than now.
I know.
Right?
I'm really excited about what you're doing. I'm really excited what you guys developed, and I'm so excited that that you're part of our team. So, sort of wrapping up here, I want to sort of segue into what I call designers after hours.
Okay.
So, I don't think you have any after hours. You might get to have a beer after work every once in a while. This guy's from Toronto, and he's here an awful lot. And I don't think you have any after hours right now. But if you did have after hours, Zach, what would you do, or what do you like to do?
Yeah. Well, I My wife and I bought a house in the Canadian wilderness about 18 months ago. And so my after hours for the last 18 months has been turning this kind of rundown cabin into a home for my family. And so I've been watching a lot of YouTube videos and buying a lot of power tools and trying to figure out how to do all that stuff. But when I'm here in San Diego, and when I'm stuck here for the weekend, I play a couple video games. That's kind of my thing on the weekend.
I know.
But that's it. That's what I do.
Okay, and here's another super fun thing about Zach that I want you to share about his wife is also an entrepreneur. So tell us about your wife's business, because that's really fun.
Yeah. So my wife is a very successful entrepreneur. She started a company when she was quite young that did e-commerce, and she sold that. And then she ran another company, which was for angel investors, and she sold that. And then she did something with hair extensions. And her new thing is called Sheerly Genius. And Sheerly Genius makes indestructible pantyhose. And you can
swear indestructible.
And you can hang a human being from stuff with nothing more than a pair of pantyhose.
There is a video. We are going to share the link
cool.
of Zach hanging his wife from a second floor balcony with pantyhose. It is a real thing.
It is a real thing.
Okay, so what are the materials that?
Like, yeah, so it's a heavy molecular weight polyethylene, which is what the fiber's made out of, and it's special in that it's incredibly strong, but also a low denier. I'm not sure how you're supposed to say that word, but it's a 30 denier fiber, which is what you can make hosiery products out of. But it's incredibly strong. It's like the strongest dental floss you could possibly imagine. And she found a way to weave this into pantyhose, but also to like wrap Lycra in it so that it's stretchy.
Oh, I see.
But it's still sheer, but it's like incredibly and ridiculously strong. So it will never run.
It's like superhero pantyhose, you guys. Really, you're gonna have fun watching this video that will connect below.
It's
and we will
cool
also connect to Upverter and E-Concierge and Zach's LinkedIn profile if you'd like to connect with him, and any other things that we think that
sounds good
that you might want to connect to. So Zach, thanks again. Looking forward to working with you and seeing what we kind of collaborate with and sort of reach to the grassroots end of the design community. I'm really excited about it. So thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks
again,
for having
me. This has been Zach Holmuth.
Yeah.
Is that close enough?
Yeah, close
Zach
enough.
Holmuth and Judy Warner with Upverter and Altium and eConcierge. And we will look forward to seeing you next time. Until then, always stay on track.